Welcome to Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. This is Jay. In this episode, we interview Tariq Khan on his book, The Republic Shall Be Kept Clean, How Settler Colonial Violence Shaped Anti-Left Repression. We'll be releasing this conversation as a two-part episode on this excellent book, which studies how anti-communism within the U.S. is deeply intertwined with settler colonialism, anti-indigenous thought, and genocidal violence. This helps us reframe our often 20th century centric view of anti-left repression in the U.S. Khan's work on the 19th century in particular also helps us to see the way things like race science, eugenics, and phrenology developed alongside the original assumptions of U.S. policing, anti-anarchist repression, lynching, and regimes of deportation. Alongside and related to settler colonial violence against indigenous people and anti-black violence, we also, through this conversation, really get into how central the repression of anarchists in the 19th century was to the development of logics and technologies of anti-left repression in the so-called United States. We can also clearly see the resonance between U.S. genocidal violence and state repression and that of the so-called State of Israel on Palestinians, something we explore a little bit more in part two of this discussion, along with delving into the presidencies of William McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt and more. This conversation was recorded this past December, so we don't reference what has happened over the last few months. But pairing this conversation with a discussion I hosted on our YouTube channel a week ago with Dr. Charisse Burton-Stelly helps us to see how many things we are constantly told represent the crossing of new red lines or the onset of a fascism that is foreign to the United States are actually foundational pillars of U.S. statecraft, science, warfare, and policing with very long histories. On the subject of our YouTube channel, we once again have been very busy over there, releasing 8 episodes over the past couple weeks. We're only 13 subscribers away from reaching 10,000 on our YouTube page, so now is a great time to sign up for free if you haven't already and help us hit that milestone. And if you haven't been following our work there, you can catch up on all the conversations we've had over there recently and over the past year and a half. We also recently set up a Buy Me a Coffee account, which allows people to offer us one-time support if they prefer doing that instead of the recurring contributions used by Patreon. You can support us in either place, and contributions from our listeners are the only financial support we receive for these audio episodes, so we really appreciate whatever you can give to keep these conversations coming. Now, here's part one of our conversation with Tariq Khan on his book, The Republic Shall Be Kept Clean. So Tariq Khan, welcome to Millennials Are Killing Capitalism. It's good to be with you today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to talk about this book. So I wanted to start, one of the things that you note from the outset in the book is that there are some gaps in how we often study anti-left repression in, you know, what we call the United States. And one of those gaps that should be obvious by the title of the book, which is The Republic Shall Be Kept Clean, How Settler Colonial Violence Shaped Anti-Left Repression, is this relationship between, as you talk about in the book, colonial counterinsurgency, which is to say the military tactics or the militaristic tactics used to extirpate, to use Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's term that she uses a lot, or, you know, genocidal tactics or tactics of kind of control and management of indigenous populations, and the relationship between that, those counterinsurgency tactics, and anti-left repression and how it develops in the United States. And so that's one thing that you're looking at. And the other thing is that many historians of anti-left repression in the U.S. really start with the 20th century and often primarily with the repression of, you know, a set of organizations, the Communist Party, groups like, you know, later on, the Black Panthers with COINTELPRO, but predominantly kind of also black and brown organizations like, you know, maybe they look at the UNIA, which was one of the, you know, first ones of kind of the developing FBI or the Nation of Islam and civil rights organizations. And so there's kind of this 20th century trajectory that, you know, starts with communists and black nationalists in a lot of ways and, you know, flows through and goes through these different left-wing organizations in terms of how the state is seeking to suppress their movements. And one of the things that you're pointing to that's left out of this discussion quite often is the repression of anarchists. Sometimes we talk about anarchists a little bit in the early 20th century, which you do as well in this book, but specifically the 19th century. Like, we don't talk a lot about anti-left repression in the 19th century, much of which was targeted at anarchists. And so say a little bit about what you see as important in studying these gaps of settler colonial counterinsurgency and the anti-left repression of anarchists in the 19th century, and some of the things that studying these gaps help us to see about anti-left repression.
Sure. So, yeah, and I mean, the kind of erasure from anarchists from our understandings of anti-left repression and even of left history in general has really led to us misperiodizing U.S. history. And, you know, I'm not the first person to point this out. Other scholars have, Benedict Anderson pointed out, even Eric Hobsbawm, who was no fan of anarchists, kind of recognized that, you know, prior to Lenin, probably from, at least the 1870s, you know, up until the Russian Revolution, anarchism was the dominant strain in the revolutionary left, more so than, I mean, the when we think of socialism, we think of it as kind of a big umbrella. You know, under that umbrella, there were many different sort of strains of socialism. We have Marxism, we became one of the major important strains. You had Christian socialists, you had these utopian, Fourierists, and earlier than that, you had these Owenites. You had all kinds of stuff going on. It really was a period of incredible experimentation. But among the strains that we would call the revolutionary strains of that, anarchism was the dominant like strain, and it was the leading edge of the communist movement. And, if you were in Chicago and you learned about Marx, you probably learned it from an anarchist. The anarchists were the ones, who were distributing the literature, who were having, talks and putting on all the events and everything like that. You know, you could go listen to Albert Parsons' lecture for 3 hours about dialectic materialism or something like that. But it really was the anarchist movement was kind of the driving force for decades. Again, not for sort of the left in general, but for what I would call the revolutionary left. And yet so many of the accounts of anti-communism don't start until sort of the end of that period. So they kind of start with what we call the first Red Scare, which largely did target anarchists. I mean, it was mostly anarchists who got deported and things like that. But by that point, the anarchist movement was kind of beginning to be on the decline, largely because of repression. I mean, if you remove, hundreds of the most effective anarchist organizers through deportation or straight up murder or imprisonment and things like this, take them out of the picture, then that left kind of a vacuum. And then within that vacuum, it became more of like your Socialist Party, your Communist Party type organizing became more prevalent from that point on. And so then most of the accounts start with that. And then they're kind of just looking at those groups and they've kind of forgotten the anarchists. Sometimes it's intentional. It's people who kind of don't want us to know about anarchism, but sometimes it's not intentional. They're just looking at what sources they have in front of them from that point forward. So part of it is when we add anarchists back into the picture, it looks a lot different and it also changes the periodization. But I'm trying to actually broaden the lens even more than that to not just look at like, groups that would have referred to themselves as revolutionary socialists, but looking at the state itself and how it talks about different peoples. And it's the first people that in the United States who U.S. leaders are calling communists are not European immigrants or anybody who are members of any anarchist or socialist organization, but it's indigenous groups. And then that takes us back into the 1840s, which is, some of your better scholars they'll start with like, maybe sometimes they'll start with like the Paris Commune. If they're looking at the United States, Paris Commune definitely had an effect on the ways that U.S. leaders were thinking about sort of capitalism and the relationship between capital and labor. And there were fears and anxieties about threats to the system. What if this spreads to the United States? And so even though the Paris Commune is not in the United States, U.S. leaders are talking about it. They definitely have anxieties about it. Or they'll talk about Haymarket, of course. I'm going further back than those things even. You know, you have the Working Men's Party that, you know, is coming out in like the 1820s. You know, you have the Working Men's Movement and all of that. But they're not largely referring to them as communists or socialists. There's a couple of, you know, there's a few sort of marginal radicals within the Working Men's Movement. But overall, it's not a radical movement. The Working Men's Movement is largely talking about just sort of like having a fair deal between the bosses and the workers. They're not talking about getting rid of capitalism or something like this. And, you know, it's the Working Men's Party were like some of the strongest supporters of Andrew Jackson, who's just this enslaver and genocidal maniac. And so the Working Men's Party is there are concerns about like mobocracy. That's a term that you see U.S. leaders use, but they're not sort of vilifying them as communists. So I was going through the congressional record. I wanted to see, like, when do we find congressmen? Or just people who are petitioning Congress and things like this. When did they start engaging in sort of modern anti-communist rhetoric? And that's really the late 1840s are the first instances I'm finding there of explicitly anti-communist rhetoric in terms of how we think of it today. It's very shortly after the term communism sort of becomes part of the lexicon. So communism hadn't been part of the lexicon for, you know, prior to that. You don't really see people using the term. Socialism had been in use. You know, you could find that, you know, back into the 1820s and things. You have these Owenites and groups like this. There mostly was like utopian type projects that were calling themselves socialists, many of them very idealist. Some of them were very religious in nature. So the word socialism was kind of in play, but communism didn't really come in play until, in the U.S. at least, until the Germans. You started to have a movement in Germany of people who called themselves communists. And this is even a little bit before Marx even. You have these Germans who used the term communism to describe their politics. There were books, I think in my book I mentioned August Becker, who wrote a book called What Do the Communists Want? And then, of course, you have, you know, Marx is giving talks as, you know, in 1847, you know, at least as early as 1847, where he's using the term and he's talking about the interests of capital and the interests of labor are diametrically opposed, all of that sort of thing. The newspapers in the United States are reporting on these German communists, and the Working Men's organs, their newspapers, while they weren't communists themselves, they were sympathetic to the communists in Europe. And so people in the United States, you know, the literate public, would have come in contact with this word. And it's very shortly after they come in contact with this word, you find congressmen using the anti-communist rhetoric as a way of pushing certain policies. And I'm finding that they're not talking about the labor movement at all, or even sort of domestic, you know, internal issues, but they're talking about U.S. warfare against indigenous people, and they're also talking about the system of enslavement. And so the first examples I'm finding are actually these Southern enslavers who are, you know, after the Mexican War, this massive land grab that the United States takes by force. Well, we say from Mexico, but they're really taking this land by force from many indigenous nations. It's actually not Mexican lands or U.S. land. This is the lands of indigenous peoples. And, you know, states always claim, you know, borders and boundaries. But the reality was these were mostly indigenous lands. These weren't people who called themselves Mexicans. These were people who identified with their own specific indigenous nations. And so what we call a land grab from Mexico is actually theft of over 500,000 square miles of land from indigenous nations. And that leads to just this massive debate in Congress about what's going to happen with these new lands. Is this going to be these new territories? Are we going to have slavery in them or not? And so it's in those debates over whether or not to have slavery in the new territories that I'm finding the first examples of congressmen using communism to sort of scare people into certain policy orientation. So like you have, it's largely people who would later go on to become the leaders of the Confederacy. But, you know, this is pre-Civil War. It's very interesting because they're kind of using Marxist rhetoric, but they're twisting it to make an argument for slavery. So, like, you know, I write about this one congressman who says, you know, of course you're going to have the threat of labor unrest and things like this and chaos in these northern cities because they have the wage system up there. And with the wage system, you get enmity between capital and labor. They actually use these kinds of words, enmity between capital and labor. And, you know, you have poverty and homelessness and, you know, he sounds like a leftist. But then he says, in the South, you don't have that kind of enmity because we have harmony because of our system of slavery ensures social harmony because you can't have conflict between capital and labor because the enslavers own both capital and labor. And so since they own both, there's no conflict. And so the argument is we need to expand slavery into the new territories as protection against communism spreading. And so you find this, these are some of the early instances of this kind of anti-communist rhetoric. And then the other major instances are these U.S. Indian agents, these men who are charged with so-called civilizing indigenous groups or more often controlling, containing, and expelling indigenous groups from these territories so that white settlers can set up shop. And so you, in some of their reports to Congress, they're complaining that, you know, particularly with the Dakota Sioux, well, you know, some of these Indian agents are saying, you know, it's impossible to civilize them because of their system of communism. This is the first time I actually see the term system of communism being used. And they're talking about the Dakota Sioux and they're basically posing private property versus to stand for civilization. And in the lack of private property and the collective sort of stewardship over resources as communism. And so they're complaining that the Dakota Sioux, none of our tactics are working on them because they have too much democracy, too much freedom. You know, one of the major tactics that colonizers use, still use to this day, is you find someone from the colonized group or the group you're trying to colonize, you sort of handpick somebody who's going to serve your interests and you make them a leader. And so with indigenous groups, you know, they had this idea of like, they have a chief, you know, they didn't actually understand anything of like how political systems worked within indigenous groups. They kind of thought there was some chief with absolute power or something like this, which was not the case. But they thought you find a chief and then you shower him with, privileges and you get him to do what you want. And then you enact your policies through that chief. And they're saying this isn't working because they have too much democracy. They're like that these chiefs can't make any decisions that are binding on their people. They bring all of these guys with them to every time they meet with us. And those guys make sure that the chief doesn't agree to anything that goes against the wishes of the people. Basically, they're saying their system is too democratic. And that they also translated as communism. And so they're saying it's impossible, you know, our benevolent attempts to civilize these savages are not possible because of their communism. And then I sort of draw a connection from that to the actual policy. So you have the rhetoric of anti-communism, and you find that it's almost always accompanies violence. And so in that case, just straight up, you know, very shortly after they're vilifying the Dakota Sioux as communists, they're rounding them up into concentration camps. And, you know, we have famously, you have the largest mass execution in U.S. history ordered by Abraham Lincoln of, I think, something like 38 Dakota people executed, reduced, actually. Governor Ramsey, who ran the territory, wanted to execute 300. And Abraham Lincoln was like, that's barbaric. Let's just do these 38, well, the worst ones. And it wasn't just official state violence. One of the things I'm doing in this book is I'm making an argument that state violence and extra legal, like sort of what sometimes we use phrases like vigilante violence or mob violence, lynch mobs, things like this. But that extra legal violence and state violence are actually the same thing, that the extra legal violence actually is part of the system of state violence. And so they were actually paying just regular settlers, regular farmers, to murder Dakota people, and they were paying them for the scalps. And so this is how the Dakota leader, Little Crow, was just this farmer, and his son found him by chance one day. He was gardening, and there was no violence, and then they just attacked him and murdered him. And they got paid, you know, something like $500 for his scalp, which was a lot of money, you know, back then. But they're basically straight up paying just ordinary white settlers to murder indigenous people. And so you have this campaign of ethnic cleansing that's a mix of just ordinary settlers murdering people sort of informally and state violence. And then in this way, they establish, you know, U.S. control over that region and white supremacist rule. And these are sort of like what I'm looking at, those types of things. When we're talking about anti-communism, we have to look at that stuff first and then look at how sort of warfare against indigenous peoples and attempts to control enslaved populations, how those things then shape what anti-communism even means in the minds of ruling class people and their forces. And then not just how they think about anti-communism, but the kinds of policies then that they conceive of for dealing with what they see as a threat from the left.
Yeah, right on. Thank you. One of the things that I remember when I heard you talk too was just this term Reds also. And, you know, obviously we're familiar with both resonances or definitions of when people say Reds, of the idea of indigenous people as red, but then also as communists, as Reds, is, you know, quite common. But I never thought of the two as related at all. And correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, I think it's a minor point in the book, but you see a relationship there in the usage, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I never thought of that either, you know, prior to doing sort of research down these lines. I kind of just saw them as different, you know, same word, but they're coming from different usages. The, you know, the socialists and the anarchists are Reds because they carry the red flag and things like this. And then indigenous groups were being called Reds for totally unrelated reasons. But when you get into the police literature is where I really saw the two terms being conflated, to the degree that there are some cases where you can't tell who the police are talking about when they're saying Reds. It's like, are you talking about these indigenous groups or are you talking about these anarchists? So like back in, you know, after Haymarket, the Chicago police were sort of in the midst of this public relations crisis. There was so much international condemnation of the Chicago police, and even not just from sort of the radicals, like even like ordinary progressives who don't really like the radicals still kind of felt like there was, you know, that the Haymarket trial was unjust and didn't fit what sort of liberals think of as what our democratic institutions are supposed to be. And so the police were actually putting out a ton of propaganda to try to rehabilitate their image. And on top of all this, by the way, the police were also being investigated for like unrelated corruption things that were going on. Like this one Chicago, I think detective was like running this slumlord operation where he owns all these buildings and he's using the police as his enforcers to extract rents from people. But he was also using the police as like his maintenance guys and stuff. So he's basically has the public, you know, paying taxes to fund his slums. And that story was coming out in the press. That's actually the reason why Governor Altgeld relooked at the Haymarket case, was he saw all this other corruption stuff that was coming out. And that made him think, maybe all this stuff they were saying about the police lying in the Haymarket case has some merit. They're lying about everything else. But anyway, they were in the midst of this public relations thing. And so they're putting out all this propaganda to sort of bolster the image of policing. And we have to remember that at this time, the institution of sort of the modern police was relatively new. Policing as we know it is a pretty modern thing. And so it wasn't like a lot of the public didn't really just take it for granted that the police are people who you're supposed to respect. You know, it was this new institution. And so it was constantly, the police were constantly trying to convince the public that they're like this integral part of the United States. And so the way they did that was by inserting themselves into these settler colonial narratives. So this is one of the things I'm arguing is, and I'm, of course, this isn't an original argument on this point, but you know, I'm drawing very much from indigenous studies scholars here. But this idea that settler colonialism is foundational to the United States. I don't think this should even be controversial, but sometimes it is. And even in labor and working class history, I've gotten so much pushback to the notion, even to using the term settler colonialism, which is just surprising to me. But
there's a funny backlash around this all right now. I mean, I think various reasons, but yeah, I mean, it's like, it is weird, especially when, you know, to the people who were doing it initially, calling themselves settlers was not, they didn't have any problem with that.
Exactly. And so, like, for example, with the police, you know, especially during the uprisings against police violence that kind of, you know, peaked in the summer of 2020, but had been going on for at least a decade before that. Some of the ideas that were coming out of that were ideas about what are the origins of policing? And people were sort of digging into seeing like, oh, look, police are, you know, our police departments evolved out of, in some places, slave patrols, or they evolved from lynch mobs and settler militias and things like this. And you do get some pushback from that, even from some people on kind of the left, whatever that means. But the police themselves in that period, they were telling us that that's what their origins were. So like one of the things I was looking at was this book that the Chicago Police Department put out itself. They published themselves. It's just called History of the Chicago Police. That, you know, comes out in the, you know, late 1880s. And it's supposed to basically make people like respect the police. And they straight up set it up as like the first police here were, they don't use the term genocide, but they're basically saying the military guys who established the first fort in Chicago, they were the first police, and their first anarchists were the Indians. This is the language they use. They say their first anarchists were the Indians. Now our Indians are the anarchists. And so they're straight up saying like, yeah, our origins are Indian killers. And they're very explicit about that. They're proud of it. Because in white U.S. Culture, that was something to be proud of. With settler colonialism, you don't just get sort of a political and economic system, but you get a whole sort of cultural system and all these myths and things that kind of give meaning and make it seem, you know, make really evil things seem glorious. And so they tapped into that myth and they inserted themselves into it. And so like half the book is just stories of earlier settlers' forces literally exterminating indigenous groups. And they use that language too. They don't use the word genocide, but they use the word extermination. And then the police say, you know, sort of insert themselves as like, we're the continuation of that. And now that the Indians are gone, we've got the anarchists. So these are our new Indians. And then getting back to sort of your question on like terms like Reds. So you find them conflating the two, like they were going after those Reds, we're going after these Reds. And so then like you find like Police Captain Shack, who wrote this massive book, the long title, the short title is just Anarchy and Anarchists. And it's another one of these PR things that's designed to kind of bolster the image of policing and of the Chicago police specifically. But he tells all these stories where he's constantly using this anti-Indigenous language to describe anarchists. And so he refers to anarchist women as squaws. He refers to anarchist men as braves. All these stories in there where he'll say like, oh, the anarchists surrounded the police station like a group of drunken Apaches surrounding the cabin of a helpless settler. This kind of language that he's using. And then he'll say, you know, but these Chicago Reds, you know, they needed their beer. He's drawing on all these stereotypes of like, you know, the alcoholic so-called alcoholic Indian and things like that. And he's applying that to anarchists. And then he's going back and forth to talking about like indigenous people and anarchists. And at some points you're like, which reds is he? He starts using the words reds and you're like, which reds is this? He's kind of using the word reds in this really slippery way where he's applying it to both groups on purpose, because it seems pretty clear that he felt like if white America would view the police as these hardy men sort of on the frontier taming the wilderness to establish civilization, then that would bolster the image of policing. And so you get this term like reds becomes very instructive. And when you look at the language, it gives us a little bit of a glimpse at like the psychology of settler colonialism. And so, yeah, that's where sort of, I think it was maybe chapter two is where I talked a lot about that notion of just the word reds alone and the slippery usage of it, and how the people who were enacting violence against labor unions and just people who were organizing the working class, how they viewed themselves as like Indian killers. And they viewed the anarchist as, in their imaginations, you know, police and other law enforcers and people like this viewed the anarchist as kind of like as Indians. Sometimes I get misunderstood where people say, oh, so you're saying the anarchists were the new Indians? And I'm like, no, absolutely not. I'm not saying anything like that. Anti-Indigenous violence is also going on alongside this. It's not like anti-Indigenous violence stopped and then this other stuff started. These are both happening alongside each other. And the argument I'm making is that the settler colonialism is so formative to U.S. institutions and to mythologies and things like this, that it then shapes the form that internal social control takes.
No, that's great. So I want to pivot a little bit and talk about how you study race in the book, which I thought this is great, you know, and part of what you're intervening in the book too is a kind of a left politics that wants to separate these things a little bit, or, you know, talk about class as though, you know, class isn't a racialized or gendered concept. But also you're looking at a very interesting period with regard to race and how people are racialized, right? Race is looked at differently in this period than a lot of people look at it today. But nonetheless, it's very formative also for how we look at race today. And so when we go back to the 19th century, you really look at how race science and racist criminology, which are really, you know, inextricable in that era, show the racializing discourses used in settler colonialism, used with anti-Black racism, but also used in anti-immigrant discourse, including among people who nowadays we would say those are white people. And fascinatingly, though, there's like a specific character that this also takes with anarchists, where there's the anti-immigrant part, and that sometimes is deeply connected to, you know, are these people anarchists? Are these people communists? But there's a specific, I mean, it gets into wild stuff, like when you get into race science and start talking about how people's skulls look and their faces look and all this kind of stuff. Talk a little bit about what you're looking at there and, you know, what you see looking at that period and race science and racialization, to borrow Cedric Robinson's phrase, you know, among different groups in this period.
Sure. And, you know, it's really difficult to talk about because it's such a complex thing, and how societies construct race changes by place and time. Even today, like the ways that the sort of, you know, who's viewed as what race, what kind of racial categories exist, it's not based on some objective science. It's based on what's going on in the political and economic and cultural and social structures of any given society, and those all change over time. I found Walter Rodney really useful as I was trying to understand what's going on with race, because the racial structure, like white supremacy, of course, is foundational to the United States, and there's, you know, there's never a period in U.S. history where that's not the case. But who's included in this group we call white changes over time. But in looking at Walter Rodney, you know, Walter Rodney was looking at Guyana, where he was from. And racial structure was a little bit different there. When he was growing up, you know, he saw you had these black landowners who exploited black working class people. You had Indian landowners exploiting Indian working class people. And he sort of talks about how it's those landowners were the ones pushing nationalism the hardest. He says, you know, the black landowners were pushing black nationalism the hardest. The Indian landowners were pushing Indian nationalism the hardest. And he's like, why is that? And he's like, it's because they're trying to break up any kind of class solidarity between like black and Indian workers by having people identify first and foremost with a racial or ethnic group rather than people who are in their similar class position as them. And he kind of looks at how in Guyana, it's your relationship to the mode of production had a major effect in how the society delineates race. So he used the example of the Portuguese after the British, you know, abolish slavery, they start bringing in people from other parts of the world to be sort of bonded laborers in these really sort of exploitative conditions. So, you know, not as horrific as chattel slavery, but certainly pretty terrible. And people don't have much freedom and they are very kind of trapped in this position of poverty. But so you have they start bringing in these Portuguese peasants, landless people from the Azores and places like this, to work in these menial jobs. And those Portuguese people were not delineated as white. Had those same Portuguese people gone to the United States, they would have quickly been delineated as white. But in Guyana, they weren't delineated as white because white was what the landowners were. And these were menial laborers who didn't own anything. And so Portuguese was its own separate race that was something other than white. And so Walter Rodney uses that as just one out of many examples to kind of show how, like, your relationship to the means of production plays a role in how societies delineate race. And so looking back at the United States, you know, we're looking at a period where you have groups coming from a lot of different, you know, from Southern Europe, from Eastern Europe. You have a lot of Eastern European Jews are working class people. They don't really own much. The Italians and they are these, you know, the Jews and Italians were kind of not viewed as white. They were viewed as something else, as some kind of suspect foreign group. They weren't sure. You know, Matthew Fye Jacobson uses this term, probationary whiteness, where it's like American society is kind of trying to decide, like, well, are these people white? Because to be American meant to be white, if you were going to be included in sort of like the democratic rights of what, you know, what they call America, that was something that was for white people. And so being white wasn't just about sort of a racial category. It was about access to resources, access to decision-making power. That's what being white was about. It was about belonging, being part of the people who matter, being part of the people who are considered people. You know, when they talk about government by the people, well, who are the people? It meant being white. And you had these immigrant groups coming. And there was people were kind of like, I don't think they're part of the people. I don't think they're white. And so you actually had a lot of these groups were being racialized and were the victims of racial violence, even were the victims of lynching and things like that. Black people, of course, were being lynched in the thousands. Every week there were lynchings. But the largest group to be lynched after that were Italians at one point. You also had another point, it's people who were viewed as Mexicans, which the term Mexican is also very deceiving at the time, because pretty much they were kind of lumping a lot of different peoples together as Mexicans. There were a lot of people who were from indigenous groups. Some didn't even speak Spanish, and they were being called Mexicans just because their indigenous group came from an area that was once within the boundaries that Mexico claimed. And so all these people were being lumped together as Mexicans. Some of them spoke, you know, Mayo and Yaqui and these different kinds of languages. Other than Spanish, they spoke indigenous languages. They came from indigenous cultures. They didn't consider themselves Mexicans. But the employer comes in and sets up their mining operation. They're lumped in with Mexicans and they're paid what the Mexican workers are paid. And, you know, Dave Roediger pointed out, like he mentioned this one mine, I think in Arizona, and he used an example of the wage differentials. You could kind of see how the society delineated race based on the wage differentials. So like they're very explicit. It would say like white workers get paid this much. Italian workers get paid this much. That was a different category. Italian wasn't white, and they got paid less than white workers. Mexican workers get paid this. That was a different category and was paid even less. And so you could kind of look at the labor system to get an idea of how the society delineated race. But there were a lot of people who they weren't considered white and who didn't consider themselves as white either. You know, even someone like Emma Goldman, who's not really, you know, I don't think she's someone that we often look to for racial analysis. In fact, she's been criticized for sort of her lack of racial analysis. Rightly so, I think. But she didn't have no analysis. She came as a Lithuanian Jew, and her understanding of racism was anti-Semitism in Europe, you know, like Russian anti-Semitism, you know, the Russian Empire, pogroms and things like this. When she thought of racism, that was her context for what racism was. She didn't have much of an understanding of like a kind of white-black racial system in the United States. And so her analysis of that wasn't as developed. It did get better over time, but she definitely has some moments where you kind of cringe when she's saying something, where she doesn't get it. But even she saw the whites of the United States as something other than what she was. And she uses these terms and letters and things. You can hear her complaining to her friends about, you know, these arrogant whites who, you know, they think they're better than everyone. Like, she talks about the whites. She uses this term, these whites. Usually there's a pejorative, like arrogant, ahead of it. But she doesn't feel like she belongs to the group that calls itself white. And she doesn't even like that group that calls themselves white. And that's just an example of just one person. But I think that's indicative of what a lot of migrant groups in the period were dealing with in the United States. And the United States is sort of deciding, are these people white or not? Well, let's see how they're going to act. And that's what it comes down to. This is really what shows how non-scientific the category of race is that it wasn't based on what they look like, what, you know, what is their biology or something like this, but it was, how are they going to act in relationship to our political and economic system? And when they became oppositional to that system, they were sort of blocked from any protections of whiteness. And, you know, some of them were lynched. Some of them were, many of them were deported, including, you know, Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, famously. But, you know, many of those folks were deported. And congressmen also posed the category of Anglo-Saxon against them. So, like, you have one this back, you know, later, I'm skipping ahead in time, but, like, at the time of these anarchist deportations around the time period of the first Red Scare, this is sort of near the end of where the time period where that my book studies, you can see them still using this language. Like, this one congressman says, you know, we don't have any communists in my state. We only have Anglo-Saxons. And this was in a conversation they were having mostly about Jewish anarchists. That these congressmen are talking about, how are we going to get rid of basically these migrant anarchists, mostly Jews. And he says, you know, we don't have to worry about it in my state because we only have Anglo-Saxons. We don't have communists. And so here you have a racial or ethnic category of Anglo-Saxon being posed against communism. And so communism is also a racial category. When they use the term communism, they're talking about people who are something other than white, other than Anglo-Saxon. So the racial politics become really tricky. And then the race science, to get to that part of your question, this to me was some of the most interesting part of the research, was looking at the race science and criminology and things like this. The race science was, you know, people, U.S. society in general, not just U.S., but also in Britain and in France and in Germany, you know, in sort of Western Europe in general and in the United States. Their ruling class is becoming very interested in evolutionary theory. Social Darwinism is becoming sort of like a justification for the cruelties of capitalism. And they're starting to apply what they think is sort of scientific theory, notions about biology even, to understand phenomenon like, why is someone organizing a labor union? What's making somebody write articles criticizing the capitalist system? And they pathologize it is a mental illness. And so they're using race science becomes a really important part of this project. It becomes part of the justification for a system that people in the United States, working class people, are increasingly just not believing in. They're seeing through the lies because it just doesn't match their experiences. Their people are being exploited. There's all these economic crises. And you have these newspapers talking about how, you know, capitalism is, you know, the synonym for civilization. Private property is a synonym for civilization. And yet they're living in these horrible conditions under this system. They're living in misery. You know, half of children in Chicago don't live to make it to age 3. So, like, the actual conditions just make people lose faith in the whole system. And so science kind of comes in to bolster sort of the lies that the ruling class tell themselves about themselves and their position in society. And so they start to psychopathologize radicals, union organizers, anybody who's sort of pushing for solidarity from below to challenge the power of capital. They classify that as a mental illness. So you have these famous criminology, you know, famously Lombroso, who's they call the father of criminology. He draws on older science, but the science that he and others like him are drawing from is completely rooted in slavery and settler colonialism also. And so they're basically drawing on science that was used to justify genocide and slavery. And they're taking that same science and now they're applying it to like migrant anarchists and people like this. And so like all that skull science and everything that they were using to justify slavery and to, you know, vilify indigenous people as less than human. Now they're applying that to European born anarchists. They're using words like atavism, saying this is going backwards in evolution. There was this belief that different races represented different rungs on like the ladder of evolution, and that the white man was sort of the pinnacle of biological evolution. Like literally they argued this, that the white man was like the pinnacle of biological evolution, and like what these other races are now is what the white man used to be, and what the white man is now these other races could become through evolution. You know, especially we can kind of speed that up with our policies and things like that. We can kind of civilize the world. Part of civilizing the world was helping the process of evolution along to make all of these so-called savages become white faster. And that was a pervasive belief. I write a lot about that. And I talk a little bit about the World Columbian Exposition and things like this as kind of a physical representation of that belief structure. But the race scientists were like, well, then what? How do we explain then when somebody who's supposed to be a white man is railing against private property? All these anarchists and these socialists, these labor union people, how do we explain them? And they explained it as what we have here is a going backwards in evolution. Some people through genetic defects and things like this devolve. And so they say, yeah, on the outside, he might look like a white man, but biologically, he's an Indian. Like they straight up that were using language like that. They were straight. They used really racist slurs. They were using, you know, the like the R word slur and things like that. Even in the French and British journals too, they were talking the same way. And so they were saying like, sure, in the, you know, if he were in a tribe of, you know, red Indians, he would be the chief of that tribe. But here in the white man civilization, he can only be a criminal. Language like that. And so the science was, they were basically making, drawing on evolutionary biology and kind of using it as a weapon, first of all, to, you know, justify colonization and genocide and slavery. But now they're also using it to justify all of this violence, to put down strikes and things like that, and to deport people and execute people who would otherwise be considered white. But they're saying, oh, they're actually not white. They're biologically, they're something else, to a degree that they're racializing anarchists, and they're using science in order to do it. And by taking people and putting them outside of whiteness, it makes them lynchable, basically. It makes them deportable. It makes it so you can do any of those things that you're doing to colonize populations, those things you're doing in Africa and the genocides you're committing against indigenous people, all of those things we're doing against them that we could, you couldn't fathom doing that against white people. But we've put this group of people outside of whiteness, and we can now conceive of doing that to them, and that will still sit well with our consciences.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know we'll get into like how that happened, I'm sure, a little later as we talk about some of the work you do around vigilante mobs and lynch mobs, as well as like the section on deportation and so on. But as you're talking about this, as a related kind of question is, you know, nowadays often we have these discussions of people will say white anarchists, right? Or this becomes a kind of, you know, and it's not to say there aren't plenty of white anarchists, of course, but it is interesting because it becomes a way to characterize anarchists as kind of a specifically sort of white group. I mean, you hear this rhetoric sometimes on the left among people who maybe they're anti-anarchists, like maybe they disagree with the politics, but they wrap it also in this language too. And, you know, it's also something I think that's connected in certain ways when you look, obviously, at the rhetoric of, you know, the ruling class or the media or policing when they think about this idea of outside agitators too, right? This idea also of, particularly in instances where anarchists, like I'm thinking about Stop Cop City, you know, in Atlanta, and it becomes a way to paint the forest defenders or stuff like that as people from outside of Atlanta and therefore not in meaningful solidarity with the black residents of Atlanta who also are opposed to, you know, this police training center and so on. And you also saw this during George Floyd rebellions. It's never totally true, but it becomes something that I think gets weaponized in a certain way. And one of the things I found interesting about this study is thinking about who all these anarchists in the 19th century, particularly, but also in the 20th, that you're looking at in the book are. And that even though some of them are certainly, you know, what we would today call white, or they kind of have that, you know, they're European descended or they're European immigrants, phenotypically white, to use that very fraught term. They included immigrants also from Mexico. As you noted, this is also a characterization that's overly broad and doesn't really consider whether they're indigenous people and so on, parts of Latin America. Native Americans, you know, there are black anarchists and so on. And there's people like Lucy Parsons, who you talk about, who's, you know, it's not quite clear totally what her background is. She kind of says different things at different points, but she was born in slavery, right? You also show, though, that there are anarchists from Europe that weren't, as we just talked about, for a lot of the reasons we talked about, they're not recognized as white, but they also, beyond just not being recognized in it, they do reject it and understand the kind of like what the project of whiteness is about and what, you know, the kind of settler colonial logics and the anti-solidaristic idea of what whiteness is. And part of what I'm thinking here is one of the anecdotes you cite kind of early in the book is you talk about some Italian anarchists and an Italian anarchist's paper, I believe, where as Columbus Day is coming into, you know, being a thing, and you mentioned the World Columbian Exposition, which for people, I mean, I know you just laid out a little bit of that, but for people who want a little more talk about that, the first conversation I had with Mtume Gant about Cedric Robinson's Forgeries of Memory and Meaning, he talks a lot about also the World Columbian Exposition. And so, yeah, just talk a little bit about particularly the Italian anarchists I'm thinking about and how they kind of could see, because a lot of times I think today, too, we also think of Italian people as the defenders. I live in Philly. And so, like, you know, the Columbus statue, the, you know, South Philly, the Columbus Day parade, like everybody knows at this point that this is a very fraught history. And yet Italians are some of the most vigorous defenders of this heritage in certain ways. And yet you have these Italian anarchists who really kind of very at the very beginning can see what's going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. The Italian anarchists had really sharp analyses of race. And I think the only reason why a lot of us don't know about that is because they were writing it in the Italian language press. And so we don't have their writings in English. But, you know, luckily we have some great scholars who know Italian and who've been able to kind of unearth some of those things for an English speaking audience. You know, I have found the work of like Kenyon Zimmer really, really useful. His book, Immigrants Against the States, what I would definitely recommend for people to read that. Jennifer Guglielmo's book, Living the Revolution. There's a ton of folks who've just done really good work in sort of unearthing some of these histories of Italian anarchists who I draw from and who I'm citing. But yeah, I was actually really surprised at how sharp some of the Italian anarchists' racial analyses were, where they were connecting racism with capitalism and colonialism, how they were criticizing Christopher Columbus, right? And that nowadays we're kind of told that, like, oh, we have to celebrate Columbus Day because this is like part of celebrating Italian Americans. And there were Italian American organizations that pushed that narrative. I actually live, you know, in the town in New Haven where the first Columbus Day celebrations happen before it's an official holiday. And part of the reasons why Italians here started pushing this Columbus mythology was because they were being discriminated against for being sort of un-American. They kind of latched onto the Columbus mythology to say, what are you talking about? It was our guy who discovered America. And so kind of as like a way to combat discrimination against themselves, as sort of a defense mechanism, they started pushing this Columbus mythology really hard and started having the, you know, I think the first Columbus Day parade was here in New Haven that came out of this church that it's right, literally right across the street from where my office used to be. And I mean, it's a beautiful church and there's nice people who go there. I'm not, I'm not criticizing them, but it was one of the early leaders of that church was like one of the main figures who started the Columbus Day. And he also started the group, the Knights of Columbus, which has a big building here in New Haven. So they actually started here and they were trying to, one, sort of defend the Italian community from being discriminated against for being un-American. But in order to do that, they had to attach themselves to this white supremacist project of genocide and this continuing project of white supremacy. So this was actually part of like how Italians became white was by attaching themselves to Columbus mythology, which Columbus mythology was starting to become really big sort of in the 1880s. You mentioned the World Columbian Exposition. That was actually created by an act of Congress, by the federal government, actually declared that we're going to have like a 400th anniversary of Columbus. And so then that was going to be the 1893 Columbian World Exposition. And it was supposed to be this celebration of the progress of civilization in America since the time of Columbus. And so it was supposed to be this big 400th anniversary thing. They framed it that way in their act of Congress. They said very explicitly that that's what we're doing. That's why they call it the World's Columbian Exposition. And then, as you mentioned, they have on the way into the exposition, there's this sort of street that goes in and that they call the Midway Plaisance. That is, you mentioned how they had different peoples organized along that in order of like what they believe the evolution happened. At the beginning end of it, they have like these African groups and they have what they call the Dahomey village and things. And they have people from those actual groups like on display, kind of like a human zoo type of thing. And then they kind of move up the chain of evolution. And so you go through them, you go through some like Native Hawaiian groups through the, you know, then as you get near the end of it, you have like the Irish village, the Turkish village, the German village, whatever. Then it opens up into what they call the white city. And then that's literally supposed to represent the white man. And originally it really was the white man. Some feminist like fought like, women are part of this too. It was like white women, you know, who are like white women are also part of civilization. And so as like a concession, they gave them like one, they gave them a women's building in there. They're like, all right, this, we'll give you a women's building. But it really was like meant to represent the progress of the white man, the white city. They still have some statues from there. You know, it was literally like white marble and, you know, all these white, you know, the color of it was also white. Some of those statues are, if you go to University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, they still have some of those statues like over in front of the library and things that they've moved from Chicago down to the university. And so you definitely had some Italians, more conservative Italians, who were also very happy to be pushing this Columbus narrative. But the Italian anarchists, a lot of these working class Italians, they hated Columbus and they're railing against him in the Italian language newspapers. They're calling him a mass murderer, a liar, a pirate, a thief. And they're making these sharp analyses of the relationship between colonialism and racialization. And they're saying how Columbus is, you know, what Columbus did becomes the basis for the extermination of indigenous groups and also the basis for the enslavement of African peoples. So they're connecting sort of the settler colonization to the system of slavery. And they see that, like, okay, so you're expelling indigenous people from the land, but you're bringing in enslaved African people to work that land. And they're drawing all of these really sharp analyses in their press. This is also the time period that many black scholars refer to as the nadir in terms of race relations in the United States, in that you have, this is the height of lynchings, like just that. We're still learning more and more. Like, we don't even know yet the extent of lynching. We're still finding more, like, it was such a pervasive thing in the United, not just in the South, but there were lynchings were happening on a regular basis in broad daylight. The people were selling postcards of the lynchings and sending them to family members. Hey, I was here. Look, you can see me in the postcard. That's me. Like, there's, you know, yeah, we have in the archives, we have like where someone like circles himself in the crowd and he sends it back to his mom in New York and says, hey, I was there. Look, that's me. And it was a mark of pride. They were celebrations of white solidarity is what these lynchings were. There's just sort of this carnival atmosphere. But that's going on at the same time as this, you know, Columbus myth making and things like that. And, you know, the Italians are writing articles railing against lynchings and, you know, the titles like The Crimes of the White Race. And so this is sort of a part of Italian history that I think is not very known in the United States, even among many Italian Americans, because this was like that first generation of Italians. There was a later generation of sort of upwardly mobile Italians who kind of distanced themselves from that, because those sort of Italian anarchists were kind of what racists were pointing to say, look, Italians aren't white. They're not one of us. So look at these Italian anarchists. Look at what they're writing about us, you know, us good white people. And they're accusing us of being all of these things. And so there was this second generation of sort of upwardly mobile Italians who distanced themselves from those working class Italians by aligning themselves with Columbus mythology and white supremacy and things like that. You find a similar process with the Irish. You know, Noel Ignatieff famously wrote, you know, how the Irish became white. But we're finding more writing along the lines of that, but like for other groups, like how the Italians became white. Dave Roediger has a, you know, good book, Coming White or something, where he kind of frames it as like the journey from Ellis Island to the suburbs. How does that happen? How do these sort of vilified, racialized groups become white? And, you know, one of the things I talk a little bit about, I don't dig super deep into it, but I touch on why are some groups able to become white by aligning themselves with the project of capitalism and the state, and other groups, no matter how aligned they are, they never become white. So I also talk a little bit about that. It's not the project of this book, but I do mention a little bit of that. But yeah, I mean, many of those Italian anarchists, I mean, they were some of the first people that the state kind of went after in these early anti-communist raids. I mean, they were going into Paterson, New Jersey, here in New Haven, where I am, all the way up the Long Island Sound, you know, Bridgeport, New Haven, up into New London. When you look at the records of like where these Justice Department thugs are snatching people from, It's all of these cities from New Jersey up through New York and then up the Long Island Sound. All of these cities where they're basically where there were industrial jobs. There's Italians in all of those cities who are organizing labor unions and who are putting out, you know, distributing anarchist newspapers and things like that and writing articles. And then one of the ways we learn about them is just by looking at, like, who's being nabbed in these raids. And it's that's where they're nabbing them from. So they're picking. Also, it's both Italian and Jewish anarchists. They were really the, for a time, it was the, you know, Italian and Jewish migrants were the backbone of the labor movement. Even if the majority of the labor movement wasn't anarchist, you would find in some cities the majority of the labor organizers were anarchists, even if the majority of the of the people themselves weren't. Those were the people who were really fired up to actually do the work of organizing these things. So the main people protesting the exposition were Black Americans who were sort of outside of it, handing out leaflets that they wrote. I think Ida B. Wells was one of the people protesting.
She was, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. You know, some of the major figures that we look back in terms of Black history and the Black left, like they were protesting. They saw through it from the start. But there were Italian anarchists were out there with them, too. And you find a number of incidences of like Black solidarity with Italian anarchists. Later on, you find like Black, one example I gave. I think I'm citing Jennifer Guglielmo's book on this example, where you have these Black communists in Harlem and Italian anarchists marching together in protest of Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. So you have these moments of there. In fact, I try to show a little bit in the book how much multiracial solidarity there was, multiracial, multiethnic, multilingual. You were talking about this notion of white anarchist, and that always bothered me a lot. Like when I first kind of got involved in like social movements and things like this, you know, way back in the early 2000s, I would hear that a lot. Oh, these white anarchists, blah, 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 blah. But like that narrative didn't match reality. Like the actual movement was very multiracial. I mean, the first anarchist conference I went to, I must have been around 2003, maybe. And it was APOC conference, Anarchist People of Color conference. And, it was not one, a single white person there. And so this was like my introduction to anarchism didn't come from so-called white anarchists, you know, but I was learning about anarchists from like people who were former, you know, Ashanti Alston was at that conference and did really good, workshop about anarchism and nationalism and things like that. And this was some of the first time I was like learning about anarchism from people who called themselves anarchists. And it was mostly Black and Latine and Asian and indigenous people who were at this conference, but also like just in the sort of protest movements that were going on. There were moments where, you know, I'd be in the, you know, the these more kind of militant type protests against like the IMF and the World Bank and, you know, World Trade Organization, all that stuff that was going on in the early 2000s, you know, and I'd be like, you know, lined up with like the folks, you know, with their masks on and everything, squaring off against riot police, you know, all those kinds of scenes. But it's like the people I'm linked arms with were oftentimes not white people, and they weren't. And it was a very gender diverse and racial diverse kind of group of people who were involved in these movements. And it always kind of bothered me when people say, oh, that's just a bunch of white boys. I'm like, based on what? Like, look at who is here. It's not a bunch of white boys. Like, yes, there are white people here. But who is saying that and why are they saying that? And then you mentioned the old outside agitator narrative. And that's an old narrative rooted very much in the histories that my book is looking at. So like, I mean, it really goes back to slavery, to where, you know, anytime there was an uprising of enslaved people, they would, you know, you could never admit that something was wrong with the system of slavery. And so they would say, oh, it's outside agitators are coming in here. These white abolitionists are coming down here from the north and they're stirring up our people, because to say otherwise would be to admit that there's actual injustice going on. And so they always had to blame it on something else. And then you find that also with indigenous uprisings too. You would find people saying, oh, it's these outside agitators. You know, at one point they were blaming the Mormons. They were saying Mormons are going out west. They're stirring up the Indians to overthrow the United States government. Obviously not true. If anybody knows anything about Mormons, they were absolutely not stirring up indigenous peoples to overthrow the government. On the contrary, they were sort of the vanguard of the settler colonial expansion into what would become the U.S. West. At the time the Mormons actually went to what would become Utah, that actually wasn't even part of the United States yet. So Mormons actually had to leave the United States to get their religious freedom. But in the process of doing so, they became kind of like the tip of the spear of settler colonialism and you know, kicked off major crises in terms of indigenous peoples being dispossessed and things like this. But again, that was that outside agitator narrative. They would latch on whatever they could do. And, you know, we saw a lot of that in the uprisings against police violence. And it's like, who's saying that and why? Largely the people who were pushing the white anarchist narrative were people who wanted the protests to stop. And so they thought, like, you could maybe shame black people or, you know, who are involved in these protests by saying, oh, it's just a bunch of white people. Or you could, it was also used to sort of justify the police violence against the movements. Because it's like, oh, the police aren't coming against us. They're just stopping these white anarchists from coming in and stirring up troubles in our neighborhoods. But that's not reality. Reality is we live in a multiracial world, and it always has been this way. And even where you do have white people involved in these movements, it's like, good, we want everyone involved in these movements. We want white people to reject white supremacy and be in solidarity with people who are fighting against these systems. Like, why would we want to shame that? So I've always be very skeptical. You know, you get these, like, you know, they'll bring in someone who doesn't even live in the neighborhood. Sometimes they'll pick, like, people who they think are, like, black leaders. And oftentimes it's someone who has no clout in that neighborhood. And they'll come in and start pushing this white anarchist thing. You know, it's because they're trying to demobilize. And so that white anarchist narrative actually becomes, like, a form of a little bit more sophisticated form of counterinsurgency to be very skeptical of. And, you know, I'm looking at, like, going back in the anarchist movement, it was always a very multiracial movement. It wasn't just a European thing. And I try to show, like, how widespread this movement was. Like, so much of, like, the early anti-colonial networks that were being forged in the 19th century, those were forged by anarchists. And it wasn't just so-called white or even European anarchists. You had Filipino anarchists, you had Puerto Rican anarchists, Cuban anarchists, you had indigenous anarchists in what would become the U.S. Southwest. A lot of the labor organizing in the mining camps and things like that, those were indigenous anarchists who were doing the work of forming those labor unions. And the indigenous anarchists were especially effective because they were oftentimes bilingual or trilingual. And so they were able to connect groups that would otherwise not be able to connect or coordinate with each other. So you have, like, these indigenous anarchists who were members of the PLM, which was, like, the Mexican anarchist group. They're simultaneously members of the Industrial Workers of the World. And they could speak, you know, Mayo and Spanish and English. And as a result, they were able to connect all these different mining camps. And they became really dangerous labor organizers. Those were, like, some of the most brutal massacres against workers were against those types of workers. And, you know, I write about San Diego 1912 and, you know, the what we called the free speech movements and things and these attacks on industrial workers of the world. But if you read the capitalist newspapers in San Diego at the time, they're constantly talking about the non-whiteness of the anarchists.
Yeah.
So they're saying, oh, they're a bunch of half-breeds and Mexicans and Indians. And these are the words they're using to describe these. And they, you know, what they're calling these groups of whooping anarchists. And they're basically saying they're not. It's a bunch of non-white people have invaded San Diego.
Yeah.
And so, like, yeah, I always be very skeptical of anybody, you know, anytime somebody comes out with this, like, white anarchist narrative. Like, what is the purpose of it?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think that you know, yeah, it's unfortunate sometimes, I think, when some of these discourses take hold within the left, because I think it's a unfortunately, it's a kind of failure to understand, you know, the counterinsurgent nature of a lot of those types of, you know, kind of lines and where they come from. I mean, counterinsurgent, if you read counterinsurgency literature, which I know you do, you have it, you know, in the book, especially with regard to the periods you're looking at, they're quite obsessed with this idea. I mean, like the idea that insurgencies have to be seen as legitimate, they have to be seen as kind of organic within the people. And they're obsessed with it on a kind of a twofold level. One, they know that particularly when you're fighting an insurgency in another country or against the kind of colonized people, that they recognize you as an imposition. And so that makes your work more challenging, and you have to develop organic kind of leadership seemingly that supports you. Otherwise, nobody's going to buy that you should be there, right? But the other side of it that they're obsessed with is solidarity. When they criticize insurgencies in some ways, like their language, they're very concerned with, I mean, they'll use language of like kind of war on terror rhetoric often nowadays, but they'll also quite clearly say that it's the internationalism, it's the transnationalism that, you know, makes these networks, these insurgent networks, so successful, right? And so I think that's something that we should also think about. You know, I can bridge this to my next question, because which you also kind of alluded to a little bit, is the anti-colonial nature and the transnational nature of the movements that you're looking at in the book. I think it's really important, because I think there's a problem that I don't want to specifically point to anarchists today, because I think that it's a problem that's much bigger than this on the U.S. left. And I don't want to overstate it either, because I do also think that anarchists and people on the left, particularly people, when I think of the left, I'm talking about people who are against capitalism, first of all, just to clarify for folks. But this is where you get the most international solidarity, I think, for sure. But there are certain groups or certain arguments that can be posed that really don't grapple with imperialism that well, or really don't grapple with the U.S.'s role as an imperial or a colonial force in other countries. And, you know, this is an area that is really important to have an adequate analysis, I think, of in terms of internationalism. And one of the things you talk about is the expressions of anarchism in the period and how deeply internationalist they were. Internationalist, obviously, because the people that were in the movement were coming from all over the world, as you're talking about, but also internationalism as in, you know, we're going to oppose the war in the Philippines, or we're opposed to settler colonialism, you know, things like this. And one of the things you cite is Benedict Anderson also talking about how a lot of these groups didn't have an issue with small nationalisms, including in the colonial world, right? Because there can be this opposition to nationalism on the left, and anarchists, I think, in particular, sometimes fall into this opposition to nationalism. And I just appreciated you pushing back against this, both as an anarchist and as someone who's engaged also, I know, in labor organizing, which is probably a place that this shows up even more in the U.S. left, honestly, is like kind of labor chauvinism, another arena where we often see, you know, kind of national chauvinism showing up on those on the left. So anyways, just talk a little bit about that as you think about it through this book.
Sure. I mean, that was like one of the major reasons why the state targeted the anarchists so aggressively, was explicitly because of the internationalism and the anti-colonial nature of the movement. And that also played into their characterizing of anarchists as savages, because in reality, anarchists really were building solidarity with groups that the state referred to as savages, and anarchists came from the groups that the state called savages. And I've written elsewhere about like the Gudder movement in South Asia against British imperialism, and they, you know, they were based in the United States. You know, one of the examples I use to kind of exemplify the internationalist, multiracial, multiethnic, multilingual nature of the anarchist movement was basically like monastery that these South Asian anarchists formed near Berkeley, California, that was supposed to be sort of the headquarters of the Gadar movement at a period when they had all been kind of, they couldn't go to India without being tortured and imprisoned and executed. So they were kind of hiding out in the U.S. West. Some of them were also in Canada, but they formed this sort of monastery. And they named it the Bakunin Institute, you know, after the Russian Mikhail Bakunin. They built there what they call the modern school based on the ideas of the Spanish educator, Francisco Ferrer. And it became the place where they were publishing their newspaper, the Gadar newspaper. They were publishing in like four different languages, at least, maybe more. You know, they were publishing in Urdu and Punjabi and all these different languages. You know, they were distributing the newspaper out to the South Asian diaspora all over the world. And, you know, British officials are finding Gadar newspapers and leaflets in military barracks in the Philippines, all over India, basically anywhere that Indian workers were being deployed, they were finding, or anywhere Indian soldiers even, they're finding them in military barracks and workers' quarters. They're all over the British Empire. They're finding these Gadar leaflets that are being printed by these anarchists outside of Berkeley. But also, it became like a site of all of this solidarity. And it's a short-lived place. I don't think it lasted more than 2 years. But, it got shut down. But you have Irish revolutionaries coming through there. You have Mexican revolutionaries, members of the PLM, who are Mexican and indigenous, are coming through there. And they're training there. They're learning. They're teaching people how to print newspapers and things like that. And so they're using it as like a this popular education thing. And you have Jewish anarchists are coming through there. You have Black Wobblies, all these different kinds of people, different racial groups, different linguistic groups. They're all coming through this same social movement space that's being run by South Asians, named after a Russian anarchist, with an education program based on a Spanish anarchist. And here you have, just all of this different kinds of activity. And other newspapers are also being printed from there, like Land and Liberty was a very explicitly anti-colonialist anarchist newspaper that declares solidarity with the colonized peoples of the world. And you talk about these, like what Benedict Anderson called small nationalisms. They're declaring solidarity with these nationalist movements that are fighting for independence from European colonialism. And some of the anarchists were themselves from those colonized peoples and were part of those movements. So, for example, the South Asian anarchists, most famously, would be like Hardayal. They're part of the Indian nationalist movement. Like, they're Indian nationalists first, but they find that anarchism became a very effective vehicle for the Indian nationalist struggle. That did lead to some tensions within these movements, too. You know, as there is today, there's always tensions within movements, and there's disagreements that people have between people who are on the same sides. That's all part of these things, you know. But there were anarchists who kind of felt like, well, they didn't like the idea of people being nationalists first and sort of anarchism being the vehicle for nationalism. There were definitely arguments over these kinds of things going on. But anarchists absolutely were part of those nationalist struggles and the independence struggles in Cuba, in Puerto Rico, in the Philippines, in South Asia, in South Africa. You know, anarchists were some of the people who formed the first trade unions. They became the backbone of some of the movements in South Africa, you know, in New Zealand. It's global. And anywhere where, like, you have the colonialist networks, you also have anti-colonialist networks. And anywhere you have the capitalist networks, you have anti-capitalist networks also. And so anarchism kind of goes wherever capitalism goes, anti-capitalism also goes. And so these movements are all connected. You know, I mentioned some of Christina Heatherton's work. You know, she had a great piece about the Leavenworth Prison and how Leavenworth Prison actually, by looking at who was in Leavenworth Prison, that gave you a kind of a picture of the internationalism and the multiracial character of the movement. So here in Leavenworth, you have, I mean, what we call Mexican anarchists, but although some of them were actually indigenous from the PLM, you have these Gutter insurgents who are in there with them. You have Irish Republicans, you have Black Wobblies, you have people, all these people from these different racial, ethnic, geographic, linguistic groups are all in prison, in the same prison at the same time, for the same reasons. They're all basically seen as like savages threatening civilization. They're threatening, you know, the war effort. They're threatening U.S. empire. And they basically turn the prison into what Christina Heatherton calls a university of radicalism. So the prison library basically becomes like a radical library. And in the prison yard, they're teaching classes. So you have the Gutter movement. They're teaching classes on like South Asian philosophy and things. Some of the Spanish anarchists and the Mexican anarchists are teaching Spanish classes. You have people doing classes on political economy. That kind of gives us a picture of like what the movement actually was. It really was international. And that's what the United States, I'm mainly focusing in my book on like what the people who hate these movements are doing, more so than I am on the people in the movements themselves. And so they're just aghast. This is what they're using in the trials that lead to all these deportations and things like this. They're saying, look at the connections, right? In the trials of Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, they're pointing directly to their connections with South Asian anarchists as evidence for why they are anti-American. And they're using these international connections as a basis to label these movements as sort of, you know, un-American, and as a basis for either prison or deportation. But yeah, I mean, think of Malatesta. I mean, Malatesta is in all over the world. He's, you know, he's this Italian anarchist, and he's in Egypt fighting against the British Empire at one point. You know, he sneaks to Argentina. I think he hides in a barrel or something at one point to sneak out of the country. But he's in Cuba at one point. He's in the United States at one point. We don't realize that. I think he ends up in Argentina. But his story is not unique. That was actually normal for a lot of the people who were in these movements, was they were all over the place. And wherever they went, they became part of the movements that were there. You know, I talk about Louise Michel and Natalie Lamel, these French anarchist women who were punished after the Paris Commune, and they're sent to this penal colony. And this penal colony is basically on what the French call New Caledonia, which is where there's indigenous groups, the Canuck, live there. And they just sent a bunch of anarchists to an island where an anti-colonial struggle is going on, which kind of backfires on the French, because now people like Louise Michel, Nathalie Lamel, and all of these prisoners from the Paris Commune are suddenly making solidarity with the anti-colonial struggle of this indigenous peoples, the Canuck people, who, and by the way, she's still remembered. There's a museum there where there's like, you know, Louise Michel display and things. Like, the peoples in many of these places remember those anarchists, oftentimes more so than even people within the countries they're from remember them. Just like, you know, there's people in other parts of the world know more about Haymarket than people in the United States do. You know, I have a friend of mine in Lahore, Pakistan, and he was showing me a picture of the labor union office there. And there's pictures of the Haymarket anarchists up in the labor hall in Lahore, Pakistan. Meanwhile, in the United States, we have labor unions that don't even know what Haymarket even is, even though this is where it happens. But yeah, the internationalism of the movement is one of the things that made the movement really effective and powerful. But it also is one of those things that is why the state targeted them, not just as like a protest movement, but as sort of anti-colonial militants who we have to go after them with the state's militarism. We're not going to treat them like we're trying to stop a protest. We're treating them like we are at war with a foreign nation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is an important thread too, as we get the next question I had was about deportation, and it's definitely connected, especially, you know, the language, the way that anarchists, I mean, we've talked about the racialization, but there's also these ways of trying to sort of delegitimize them as citizens, right? Or like proper kind of subjects of the state, you know? And obviously the title of the book is The Republic Shall Be Kept Clean, which refers to the deportation of Italian anarchists. Later on in the text, you pull in J. Edgar Hoover on this point about his participation in the deportation of anarchists, which is prior to the creation of the FBI, and it goes back further than many folks do in terms of looking at his career. I mean, it's amazing what a long career he had and how many episodes of counterinsurgency and repression that he's involved in along the way. But it's interesting, too, because, you know, obviously you're writing this book, I'm sure, over a period of years, part of it during the first Trump administration. And now we're heading into the second. And there's at the time, like one of the things I see you kind of also pushing back against in the text is obviously people started to contextualize Trump within as an expression of fascism, or the deportation regimes and things like this, you know, as expressions of fascism. And you note that these expressions, right, not to disagree that they're fascist expressions, but that they, you know, they occur and exist within a long history of settler colonialism, as well as anti-left repression in the U.S. Also, there was a lot of talk, I'd say more than this past administration, although it's not because, I mean, this last administration was particularly horrible as well, but there was more talk about anarchists, I feel like, partly because of Antifa and stuff like that, you know, amid the first Trump administration. And one of the things you do here is to reject the displacement of the politics of something like Trump onto European fascism, and even rejecting, of course, this discourse that sort of needs to go to Nazis or like 20th century European fascism as like kind of an origin point for how we think about fascism. Of course, because European fascists learned and cite a lot of U.S. settler colonialism and Jim Crow segregation and things like this, but also because the U.S. ruling class doesn't need to look elsewhere to find these tactics. It's not like we have to go to, you know, Germany to look at what the Nazis did in order to bring tactics to the United States along these lines. They're products of a long history of colonial counterinsurgency, as you show here, that they themselves perpetuate within the United States. And so talk a little bit about the rise of deportation as well as settler colonial displacement, because part of what you're looking at, too, is like sometimes it wasn't deportation. It was just like you got to get out of this town and go over there. Right. And so displacement within this arsenal of U.S. state repression.
Sure. I mean, you know, what in history we call the Bisbee deportation, they weren't deported out of the United States. They were just taken away from Bisbee. They actually just took them in cattle cars out into the desert far away and just kind of were like, good luck. And it's a similar thing with some of these pogroms against Black communities where, you know, sometimes we incorrectly use this term race riot to refer to things that we should be calling pogroms. You know, like what we call the East St. Louis race riot in 1917. That wasn't a race riot. That was a pogrom. That was organized, like a very organized campaign, one-sided violence to displace an entire community, to displace Black people. And they weren't deporting them to another country, but they were expelling them from East St. Louis through just really horrific kinds of violence. I actually compare the kind of violence of the East St. Louis pogrom to the Sand Creek Massacre in terms of like the taking of body parts as trophies and the kind of celebratory just cruelty that was going on during that. But yes, so much of this happens before there's any kind of, before the word fascism is even being used, like decades before the word fascism is being used, the things that we might consider to be things that fascists do were things that colonizers were doing. And so fascists actually were learned. Fascist violence grows from colonialism. Now, this isn't an original insight that I'm having. I mean, plenty of, especially Black radical scholars have been saying this. Aimé Césaire, the poet from Martinique, you know, famously in his discourse on colonialism, talked about what he calls the boomerang effect and how everything that, you know, he wrote this shortly after World War II, and the world was kind of learning a little bit more about the extent of the Holocaust and things like this. And Césaire talks about how, you know, all of these horrific things that, you know, the Nazis do and these European fascists were doing within their countries, they did all of that first outwardly in their colonies. So, like, you could look at Germany long before there's anything called a Nazi exists. You know, Germany is doing concentration camps in Southwest Africa, you know, and they're committing genocide in Southwest Africa. You know, I talk about, like, how they have Herero women in these concentration camps processing the bodies of their own people. And they're having to, it's just a horror show. You know, they're having to scrape the flesh from the bones of their own people so that then they can ship those bones to research collections in Europe and in the United States. We still have many of these bones in fact, a German collection that came from the Herero genocide, I believe, unless something has happened since my book came out. At the time my book came out, at least, we still had Felix von Luschan's collection in the Museum of Natural History in the United States that came directly from that genocide. But they're doing concentration camps. And the concentration camps, you know, that actually goes back to Spanish colonialism, you know, originally were called reconcentration camps that Spanish colonizers were using in the Americas. And then the United States, in its invasions of Cuba and the Philippines, they use concentration camps. They also are using concentration camps against indigenous groups in North America. You know, I mentioned the Dakota Sioux. They, you know, when they did that mass execution, that happens in a concentration camp. So these tactics that we think of as what European fascists do, colonizers are doing this first. Spanish colonizers, German colonizers, later, you know, British colonizers, later U.S. colonizers. Everything that we call fascism, and this is what Césaire argues, is things that they already did, and in some cases were still doing in the colonies as methods of establishing colonial control. And so that's really what we need to look to is colonialism to understand these things. And, you know, Hitler, you know, he very famously looks to U.S. policies against indigenous nations as a great example and as something to base what he was going to do in Germany on. And he even uses some of the language. So he looks at these U.S. colonizers using this language of the Wild West, and he starts using the term the Wild East to talk about the groups that he's going to go after. And he very much praises U.S. genocide against indigenous groups and also the science that Hitler is using. You know, I'm at Yale, which was where sort of ground zero for the eugenics movement, where we had the American Eugenics Society here in New Haven, and we had the Institute for, I'm blanking on the name now, but they had, you know, Robert Yerkes and Angel, who became a president of Yale. He was a Yale psychologist. And all these guys, Madison Grant was over here, Institute for Social Relations, that was the name of it. It's what the Yale Medical School is. But if you go to the Yale Medical School, you look at the front, on the front of the building, it still has carved in there, it'll say the Institute for Social Relations. That was this major eugenics center. And Nazi officials, there's letters going back and forth between these Yale eugenicists and Nazi officials, and Nazi officials are writing them letters praising them for all this great research and how useful it is. And they're proud of it. They don't see this as like a sign of like, oh, we must be on the wrong track. Nazis like what we're doing. They're very proud of the international recognition that they're getting for their eugenics research. But so much of like that kind of eugenics science, you know, so-called science that, you know, Hitler is putting into practice in Germany, you know, against Jews and Roma and LGBTQ people and religious minorities and any group that was, you know, seen as something un-German. He's learning that directly from people in the United States. And where are those people in the United States learning it from? They're learning it from the U.S.'s own history of settler colonization. So the title of the book, The Republic Shall Be Kept Clean, that's a quote of Senator William Vail, who was kind of on the he was actually watching as the SS Buford, this very famous deportation episode when they load up something like 250 suspected anarchists, all of whom were born within the borders of the then Russian Empire, mostly Jews, and they were being deported. And William Vale, you know, makes this comment as the ship is leaving, and he says, "The Republic shall be kept clean, and in its cleanliness shall endure." And people look at that and say, that's Nazi rhetoric, which, yes, it is Nazi rhetoric, but he's saying it before the Nazis exist. And so they're not drawing from European fascism. And so I kind of look at, I'm like, well, what is he drawing from? Because everything I read on him makes the Hitler comparison. But I'm like, there's no Hitler yet. So who is he getting this from? And so I'm like, well, let's look at who William Vale is. And he was another one of these Yale graduates. And his whole life was sort of as an agent of settler colonialism. He works for the railroad. He's a railroad company lawyer. And the railroads is directly connected to what they call the Indian War. So much of what we call the Indian Wars was about protecting the railroads. He's involved in campaigns of ethnic cleansings in the U.S.-Mexico border region when he's in the military. He's in these units that are patrolling that region and basically ethnic cleansing. And like that's his background. And so when he says the Republic shall be kept clean, we don't need to compare him to Hitler. Like, let's compare him to the actual context that that language of ethnic cleansing comes out of. And that directly is a thoroughly U.S.-American discourse that he's engaging in when he says the Republic shall be kept clean in terms of these deportations. And in relation to that specific deportation, you know, that J. Edgar Hoover plays a major role now. He's young. He's like 24 years old or something. I forget his exact age, but like, you know, he's in his mid-20s. He's this young, very kind of arrogant anti-communist. And he's involved with these raids during what we call the First Red Scare, which is kind of like the end of my book, is kind of where most people start their studies of anti-communism. That's sort of the end of my book. But J. Edgar Hoover is part of this campaign where they're rounding up all these anarchists, and he personally oversees the loading them up onto this ship to send them to what he calls the Russian frontier, which, again, you get this sort of cowboys and Indians rhetoric that they're using, and, you know, their natural habitat, the Russian frontier. Because, again, it's this idea, the anarchists don't belong in civilized society. They belong on the frontier. They're this wild, savage kind of people. And I actually had to kind of laugh when I'm looking at some of the sources, because J. Edgar Hoover is like complaining about how sarcastic and disrespectful the anarchists are constantly being to him, even when they're behind bars. He's like, they're just constantly making fun of him. And he's this, you know, 20-something-year-old kid, really. And he thinks he has all this clout and authority, and the anarchists are just like, you're nobody, man. And they're just laughing at him. He complains about I'm a Goldman, you know, and he's like, haven't I given you a good deal? You know, his idea was like, I'm not executing you or putting you in prison. I'm deporting you. That's a good deal for you. And, you know, she's just kind of, she was, you know, 50 something years old at this time. And he's this 20 something year old arrogant kid. And he thinks like he's going to talk to her as like her equal or something. And she just puts him down and is just like, you know, it's as good of a deal as you could do. And she's just like, you know, you can't expect something from somebody more than what they have the capacity for. She just kind of puts him down in like this way that I don't even know if he realized he was being put down, but he's kind of complained. But that's where he started his career. Is J. Edgar Hoover started his career as an anarchist hunter. And he ends his career hunting Black radicals and people who are involved in the American Indian movement. So I think that that's kind of like, as bookend, you could kind of look at like Emma Goldman and maybe like Assata Shakur and Angela Davis as like bookends to J. Edgar Hoover's career. And he begins his career going after radical racialized women, and he ends his career going after radical racialized women. And whether he was in the beginning of his career, he's going after anarchists. At the end of his career, he's going after like these Black and Indigenous anti-colonialists. But to him, it was all the same thing, whether it was anarchists or Indigenous people or Black people. It was all the same thing in his mind. And that was the case for so many of the officials carrying this out, like whether they were waging warfare on the so-called frontier, or they were putting down the railroad uprising. It was the same war. And in fact, there was the exact same units, many cases, same units, same tactics, same weapons that they're using to put down. Like they, you know, during the 1877 railroad uprising, they pulling in units from the so-called Indian Wars, and they're using the exact same tactics and weapons that they had just used against indigenous groups. Now they're using against workers in U.S. cities, in Chicago and in New York and in Pittsburgh and places like this. The exact same tactics of indigenous extermination they're using as tactics of labor control.
Thank you.